I'm Julia Go, and today I have the honor to talk to Karen and hear another story of baby loss. And I am really grateful to have the chance to talk to so many women and let them share their stories so other people can learn that they're not alone and see what they resonate with, see that their struggles are not unique, and that there is support everywhere. So thank you so much for being here, and yeah, please introduce yourself.
I'm Karen. I'm mum to 8 children. I've got 7 here on earth. Our 7th child, a daughter, Elisabetta, she passed somewhere around 16 weeks gestation in April, what was it, 2014, so 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now, so it's been a while. Yeah, it's been really interesting journey, I guess, if we want to coin a phrase that, yeah, it was something completely unexpected. I'd had, 6 fairly uncomplicated pregnancies, delivered 6 babies, pregnant with our 7th, and there was no indication that anything was wrong. So at a routine appointment with my midwife, we sort of were listening for the heartbeat, and it was just wasn't very clear, couldn't really get a good sound on the Doppler. So she suggested that perhaps I go and have a scan just to check what was going on. There wasn't really a huge need or feeling of concern. It was just, you know, the baby wasn't in a good position necessarily to get a good reading. So I went for a scan. I took my 3-year-old daughter with me. Yeah, we went in the scan, and that's when things took a very drastic turn. The images on the screen were just too dark. There weren't any of the normal kind of, I'd say, sort of grey, swishy areas that I was accustomed to seeing. It was just, there were images, but they were quite dark and they were different, and I was starting to get a bit concerned. And then the sonographer just very simply went, I can't find a heartbeat either. And I was in shock. I wasn't quite sure what I'd heard. I was like, what do you mean? There was one before, maybe. I don't really, my mind was racing, but I just lay there and said nothing. So she sort of said, well, I need to take a few measurements. Is that okay? And I was like, yeah, sure, fine. Still not quite sure what was going on. Mm-hmm. So she continued doing her thing. And then she says, oh, well, I need to talk to a doctor. Do you want to ask any questions? And I said, the first thing that sprung into my head when you go for an early scan is, I need to pee. So she said, that's fine. I'll talk to the doctor, you go to the bathroom, when you come back, then I'll talk to you then. That was fine. Off I went, came back, sat in the room, waited for maybe 10, 15 minutes, I don't know, the passage of time went a little sideways, and she walked back in the room and said, you can go now. And I was slightly stunned, and I picked up my daughter and I picked up my bag and I walked out of there and I got into my car and I started driving home. And then I was thinking to myself, what just happened? I'm not really sure. I suddenly realized I wasn't processing things at all. I was driving along a very busy street, and I was at the lights, and I'm like, are the lights red or green? I can't tell, I'm not really sure. Then I thought, actually, I shouldn't be driving. I need to find somewhere to stop.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the course of all of this, something clicked over in my head, and what I thought I heard in my head was, the baby's dead, which I must have said aloud, because then my three-year-old started screaming and crying from the back seat of the car. And then I was like, okay, that wasn't in my head. I said that out loud. I'm not sure what the traffic's doing. I need to stop.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for me, I had to drive through the center of Christchurch. There were no parking spaces, and stopped the car somewhere along the way. Once we got past the center of the city, and we just sat in the back of the car, and we just cried. So eventually I was sort of like, well, time constraints, I've got children I have to pick up from school, and I need to, you know, get on my way. So picked her, sort of put her back in a car seat, and magically found a lollipop in my bag, said, here, suck on this. That kind of calmed the noise, and I continued on my day. Went, picked up my younger two from school, went home, and I'd left a note for my older children. They came home from high school. Where were you? You went home. What's wrong? And then I had to tell each of them what was going on. So that was a whole lot of interesting things all going on at once. I wasn't really sure what was happening, what was going on. I was having to tell my children that their baby brother or sister had died. I then had to deal with their grief, and I was still in a weird, very numb kind of place of what on earth is going on. So that kind of, probably about a half an hour, 45 minutes after getting in the door, I get a phone call from my midwife, and she says, I've just had a call. You know, that's really unexpected. How are you coping? What's going on? Have you phoned your husband? I said, he's in a meeting all afternoon. I can't get hold of him till maybe 5 or 6 o'clock. She then says, she said, hold tight, I'm coming over. So she got in her car and she came over. She was wonderful. And then we just sat and we talked through what was going on and what we might have expected to happen in the following few days and things. And she said, right, well, we have to make an appointment with the hospital, and then you will go and talk to the people, the appropriate doctors and things at the hospital, to see how we're going to manage this with it being 16 weeks. So that was Wednesday the 9th of April. So then the following day we went into the hospital to talk about what we were going to expect could happen. So I was told that I could miscarry naturally at any point in time. But since it hadn't already happened, that I was at quite a great risk of infection, and that perhaps I needed to take medication to kind of help bring on labour and then deliver baby. So we said, okay, that's fine. So it's the Thursday, and then they says, but you have to take the medication a couple of days before the actual induction of labour. So we can't do it now, you have to wait till after the weekend. So that was all good and fine. We spoke to a bunch of people. We went home and told to return on Sunday to take the appropriate medication to kind of help detach the placenta. So we proceeded along the way. I went into overdrive and went, okay, not telling anybody. I'm told my immediate family what was happening and two friends, so that if I needed someone to talk to, I'd have someone to offload onto. My husband was like, we need to tell everybody. And I says, no, we can't tell everybody, because they'll go, oh, she's miscarried, and forget about it. And then, you know, baby will be born, and I want to be able to tell them, is baby a boy or a girl, what their name is, how heavy they are. I wanted to have like a normal birth announcement. So I said, no, we're not telling people. So that was fine. We spent the next couple of days organising people to look after the older children while we went to the hospital. We tried to organise as terrible as it seems, somewhere that will do a cremation for a baby that young, because it then later transpired that we'd been misinformed and that there was an agreement with one of the funeral directors and the hospital that they'll come to the hospital and collect the baby's body and then do the cremation. So my husband spent the day phoning different crematoriums to find out if they would help, which was quite difficult, obviously. And then I did what I do best and I immersed myself into getting organized. A baby was coming. And so I knitted a hat and I sewed a gown and we made a casket. We just got a box and each of the children had a part of the box that they drew a picture or wrote their name or stuck stickers or whatever they wanted to do. So that sort of occupied the weekend. And so went in for the appointment on the Sunday, took whatever the medication was, which I have no idea what it was called. And then we just kind of settled into, we were told that the majority of women will start bleeding after they had the medication and that it could be quite a sudden and heavy bleed or it might not be. So then my husband got really stressed and said, right, you're not leaving the house and we're not doing anything, which, yeah, it suited me fine. I didn't really want to go out and see people. But then, yeah, it was sort of, it would have been the Palm Sunday. So yeah, the whole kind of, it's all intertwined with Anzac Day and Easter. And it was quite a drawn out process from the beginning to the end. So, so we had a couple of days of taking the children to school and we had people going, oh, I've heard you're pregnant, congratulations. And I'm like, no, I just need to have a quiet word with you and take a deep breath and let's just move on with that. So it would have been the Tuesday the 15th. So 6 days after we found out that Elisabetta had passed, she was delivered. So that's a whole other trauma in itself. We went into the hospital. I tried talking to the nurse that my previous delivery had taken 45 minutes from the beginning of active labour through to the delivery, and that I was worried that it would be a really rapid delivery again. And she turned around and says, we can wish. It's not like that. I've done heaps of these. That's not going to happen. It's going to, you know, you're going to have the medication, you're going to do this, you're going to do that, and you might deliver sometime later today. If you're lucky, it will be, you know, just after lunch or it might be later. And I was like, okay, fine, whatever.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, really interesting. And then she came in with 2 Panadol and she said, here, take this, because, you know, you might be a bit uncomfortable, so just take some Panadol and... that's going to help with labor pains. But I was like, okay, fine. I'd gone in, I was still having morning sickness. I'd been vomiting all morning. I had a headache. I thought, well, if anything, the Panadol might just help with headache. So that's fine. The induction was started and I was lying on the bed and things started to move quite quickly. And I could feel my cervix dilating. 7th baby, very in tune with my body. I knew what was happening. The nurse had sort of left straight afterwards. I was with my husband. About an hour after the whole process had started, I kind of felt like I needed to go to the toilet. But as soon as I stood up off the bed, I was like, no, I don't really need the toilet. I'm going to have a baby. But knowing that my husband's a bit squeamish, and I thought, I'll just go into the bathroom. So I ended up delivering her into the commode on my own in the bathroom. She came out in, she came out intact. Everything, the placenta, everything all came at the same time, which was, I guess, not too traumatic. But then I was just, once again, I just went kind of numb and I couldn't breathe and I just needed to get out of there. So I kind of went out of the bathroom and hugged my husband and I was sobbing and I'm like, I've just had the baby. You need to get the nurse. So he pressed the bell to get the nurse to come in. Then about 10 minutes later, she popped her head through the door and says, oh, would you like a cup of tea or something? And I said, I've had the baby. And she said, are you sure? And I said, I'm very, very sure. Yeah. Wow. And so she went into the bathroom and she put the lid of the commode down and then pushed the whole thing out the door. And I was like, and it was like, there's my baby. Bring my baby back. Where are you going? What are you doing? And I was just really stressed and worried that they would just dispose of, do something. I had no idea what was going on.
And she didn't say anything to you?
No, she just off. And then a little while later, she kind of popped her head in the door and said, do you want to see the baby? And I went, yes, most certainly.
Yeah.
So then she went off again. And at some point she came in and says, oh, well, when I bring the baby back to you, would you like the chaplain to come and do whatever it is that chaplains do? And my husband's Catholic and I'm not. So the chaplain would have been fine. I was quite happy. But I'd said to him, you know, I understanding that things for Catholics are a little bit more one-sided, that it's Catholic or not. And I said, it doesn't actually worry me who comes. It's fine by me. But if it matters to you, then it's your call and you can say. And he says, I think I need the priest to come. And the nurse argued with him that it would be so inconvenient because the priest would have to come from the public hospital, which is in an adjoining building. It's not like it's 5 minutes drive. It's literally a walk through a corridor. And I was just like, whatever he says, that's fine. So she was like, and went off and, worked that out. So then Elizabeth was brought back to us and I'd said to the nurse, you know, I had been to the toilet and I'd lost quite a bit of blood and I said, look, I'm actually bleeding quite heavily.
Yeah.
And she once again just went, well, you've got to expect that. And I was, no, this is a lot of blood for me. I know what I'm talking about. And she just sort of dismissed it and went off. So we had Elizabeth with us for a few minutes. And then the chaplain and the priest, sort of the nurse came and said, they're here. Can they come in? Are you ready? And I said, look, I'm really, really sticky. I'm feeling really uncomfortable, really sticky. Can you help me change my pad? Because I'm really feeling quite nauseous and I'm, you know, really, really tired feeling. And she lifted up the sheet and went, oh, you're bleeding. And then had half a panic attack and was rushing around and things got a bit fuzzy. I started losing kind of a bit of the concept of what was happening around about then. And I think the priest came in, said a prayer very quickly. And then I had doctors and people pumping me full of drugs and I was being attached to a drip and things were happening kind of fast. And I was a wee bit vague on what was going on really. I was, still losing quite a lot of blood. So, I think things started to sort of settle and they were quite happy just to sort of wait and see for a little while. Then I got given a social worker to talk to, which I have heard that it's quite lucky to get a social worker. So she came in and she was just sort of talking to me and I could just feel myself drifting. And I thought, if I close my eyes right now, I'm going to lose consciousness and I'm not quite ready to do that. So I just fought it. And I know that I must have become quite incoherent because she keeps saying, oh, can you say that again? So I don't know if I just wasn't talking as loudly as I thought or if my speech was unclear, but things were a little bit odd. And then, a bit of time passed. She sort of finished up. The nurse came back and said to my husband, oh, well, you may as well go home because have some lunch, check on your kids, come back at 3 o'clock and you can go home. And I grabbed his hand and I held it really tight and I said, I don't think I'm going home. There's no way, I'm not well enough. And he said, but that's what the nurse said. I said, okay, fine. And I knew that for him that he probably did need to take a break and get some fresh air and just deal with some of what he was feeling and processing some of those thoughts and things. So that was fine. So he left and I had a bit of a sleep. And fortunately, they'd left Elizabeth and they have little cardboard caskets. And she was laying in the bed beside me, so that was quite nice for a while. And then my midwife came up to visit because she was working at the hospital that day, so she'd popped in. And she was, you know, in a bit of a, she's in a bit of a weird kind of mood. I said, well, what's wrong? And she said, would you believe they weren't going to let me in? And she said, I'm in my hospital uniform and everything, and they were, it's not visiting time, you can't come in. And she's like, I'm this person's midwife, you've got to let me in. So they, after a bit of an exchange of words, she came in and, you know, she asked to look at, see Elizabeth, and she googled and guard over her and sort of said, you know, she's really lovely and all the things. So, I mean, that was really lovely. I mean, one of the, one of the good things that the nurse who was in charge of my care that morning, she'd given me one of the Sands memory boxes, which had a blanket and things, but she'd sort of said, oh no, she's too fragile, I can't do hand and footprints, which was one of those secondary losses because I'd kind of hoped that we would get some hand and footprints. And in hindsight, we probably could have done them. But because she said, oh no, she's too fragile, we just went, okay. And looking back, it wouldn't have mattered really if we had to use the wet ink pad or whatever. It wouldn't have, you know, we'd have at least had something. So there was that. So I think it must have been about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They said to me, can you contact your husband? And, you know, how are you feeling if we sort of suggest that you stay in overnight? And I'm like, considering I'm still hooked up to a drip, I think it's probably prudent. What are you going to do? Unplug me, push me out the door? I don't know.
See ya.
So it was like, fine. We had planned on taking Elizabeth home prior to that, but then because things had changed and I'd kind of come around to the understanding that if I took her home, she may not ever leave. And that taking her to the funeral home was going to be too hard. So I'd sort of said to Franco, well, we'll go with the option that the hospital has, that somebody comes to the hospital and takes her. And plus, I kind of thought over, you know, it being longer away from the delivery than it would have been by the time we had her home for a while, her condition would have deteriorated quite a bit. So that was fine. So the kids came in, we'd taken a couple of photos home. They weren't particularly nice photos, they were just ones that had been printed out on the hospital printer that the nurse had taken. So he'd taken them home and the kids had seen a picture, and that he'd sort of, I said, they need to have the option that if they want to see her in person, then that's fine. And if they don't, that's fine too. So some of them opted to have her casket open for a little while they were there. And some of them opted to go off to the TV room, and that was fine as well. They'd all written like a little letter to go in the casket with her, which was really sweet. And then they all went home and I was left. And I think it must have been maybe around 6 o'clock in the evening. The nurse came in and says, "Oh, well, would you like me to put baby in the fridge now?" And I was like, okay, my rational science side of my brain was like, wise, prudent thing to do. But my heart's screaming like, seriously, no. So I just kind of went, yeah, okay. She said, you know, she was really lovely. Just, you know, after the change of shift. And she says, you know, look, at any point in time during the night, if you want her to be brought back, we'll bring her back. In hindsight, I kind of regret my decision at the time, but I was kind of in a space that if I have to say goodbye again, I don't think I can. And saying, letting her go off to the fridge, like literally the fridge, just that once. And I was like, I can't separate myself from her again. So this is going to be it, I think. And the following morning, my husband came and I was feeling better. So I went home. So yeah, walking out of that hospital, not recommended. It was the most surreal thing. Like, yeah, you just walk out into the world and everybody's normal. And you're thinking like, this huge thing has just happened. How can you not notice? There must be like ripples through the universe or something. You expect there to be something.
People looking at you and seeing it.
Yeah.
Looking at you and knowing.
I'm just walking out of the hospital carrying my bag and a little box and that's it. Thanks. Mm-hmm. What do I do now? So, I'll tell you what I did. I went to playgroup with my small daughter and we did a music and mother and baby music session because life goes on. And I think, you know, that's my way of coping is just get on and do it. And with having the other children, I can't curl up and cry for days on end. I can't. Mm-hmm. So, so that was that. She was taken off to the crematorium. We then went into Easter, so we went, must have been the Tuesday straight after Easter. We went and we picked her up from the crematorium, and because with Easter and things, we weren't able to we could have, but because we didn't know how long the crematorium would take, we decided to sort of hold off organising a service. So we sort of made contact with the parish that we go to, which is a Catholic church. And my husband phoned the office and says, you know, we've lost baby, we want to have a service. And she said, yeah, that shouldn't be a problem. And he said, well, don't you need to know her name or anything? She says, oh no, that's not important. So yeah, interesting. Mm-hmm. So, we kind of were like, okay, now what? Not once did we get a phone call from the priest. Not once did he knock on the door to ask how we were. Not once did he approach us at church. Mm-hmm. Nothing. We then got a phone call from one of the parishioners who, I mean, she's a very lovely, well-meaning lady, but I didn't know at the time that she'd actually lost a baby 30-odd years ago. And she's never really spoken about it. So she had been given the task to talk to me to see what we wanted in the funeral. And she was obviously struggling. And I was like, no, something's not right. But because she was not coping, she was quite abrupt. And she said some things that were actually really quite hurtful. And it just got to the point that I was like, I can't do this. Yeah. And I'm not the kind of confrontational person, but I turned around and said to my husband that he could just go and you know, he could just go and deal with himself, because I was going to go, I grew up in a Presbyterian context. So I said, that's it. I'm going to go back to the Presbyterian church. And luckily for us, I grew up in Dunedin, and we now live in Christchurch. Well, the minister who had been at the church that I went to as a teenager, he married us. He had since moved to Christchurch and was in a parish that was quite close. So I emailed the parish office and said, this is what's happened. I've got some real conflicting stuff going on. I just need somebody to talk to kind of help me work through some of the stuff, because I'm at a bit of a loss. He, within like half an hour, he phoned me. He said, I can't do much now. I'm just heading into a meeting. I just wanted to phone to say that I've got your message. I will come visit you what time suits. I'm free at these times. So before the end of the afternoon, he was sitting in our living room. He was praying with the children. We, you know, doing all the things that we had expected from the parish we were attending. Mm-hmm. He talked through a lot of the issues that we were having. He said there are lots of options. He laid out all the ways that we could go ahead. We could get a different priest. We could go to a different church. He could organize a Catholic priest in a neutral building. He said he'll facilitate whatever it is we need. He said, but I don't want you to make a decision right now. He said, you need to think about this, because this is important, and you're going to call me tomorrow, and you've got plenty of time. Call me tomorrow, and whatever it is, I'll get it sorted. Mm-hmm. So we sat down, we discussed it, and I said, look, I want him to do the service, and I want him to do it in his parish, because we've had it's the parish that we've, from time to time, whenever I felt the need to go somewhere that's not the Catholic Church, that's the parish we've been going to infrequently. So I said, I'd like it to be there. So he said, fine, you know, we'll make it happen. So it was then it was the week after that. So I think it was the 30th of April by then, that we finally had a funeral service. One of my four siblings came to the funeral. My parents are elderly and travel's difficult for them, so they didn't come. My husband's family is all in Switzerland. They didn't come. We had quite a few friends and people from church and people roundabout who came for the funeral, which was really nice. So I'd spent quite a bit of time in that time period sort of putting together like a little PowerPoint presentation, and we chose music and doing all the things. So the day of the service, we'd taken her ashes, and we had a kind of a shoebox size box that we'd put her ashes in, and I think my mother had sent something to put in the box, and so we had put a few things that were quite personal to us in that box, which was, you know, she was in there. There were things that were important to her and us that were in there. And I remember on the morning of the service, and because I'm half Chinese, we'd opted to go with one of the Chinese traditions that at funerals you give, all the attendees gets given an envelope. And in the envelope, there's a handkerchief, some coins, and some sweets. So the symbolism behind that is obviously a handkerchief to wipe away the tears. See now. Mm-hmm. sweets just to sort of take the bitterness away. And and a coin just to sort of to represent the journey that's come. It was a hard day. So yeah, we'd organized all the things, and we sort of planned on having a picnic, but it was the most heavy torrential day the day before, and we're like, okay, it's going to be a mud pool in the park that we had chosen to go to. So we said, right, plan B, and everybody rallied around, and there was food and things that was organized, which was amazing. So then, yeah, that just getting in the car to go was, yeah, probably second hardest to leaving the hospital, just because that was kind of the finality really hit then. Yeah, don't do this often, actually. It's been a while. So after that, there was kind of the kind of confined kind of period that we sort of, you know, that whole hello and goodbye was quite, for us, quite a drawn out process. And so we had to go through Easter, which is about sacrifice and death, and Anzac Day, which is about the sacrifice and death, and which is like, this really sucks. April is the suckiest month.
Yeah.
Because there's so many triggers and so many things that you go there and you're like, yeah, losing it. So, yeah, and then it was just getting back into, because it had been like the school holidays, so we had the kids home. And so then it was kind of coming into when I was actually at home by myself. Back into the routine of things, and then getting into things like folding away the maternity clothes, you know, putting away, I'd started buying some nappies and things and packing all of those things away, and yeah, just getting back into the normalness and the routine, and trying to grieve in a way that was not destructive to the family, but also trying to support my husband, who did the man thing and thought that he was supposed to just carry everybody, and whatever it is he was trying to do, he wasn't achieving it. And I'd been calling on friends or anyone I could think of, and I'd sort of say, hey, can you just take my husband out for a couple of drinks one night, you know, take him to the local pub, just let him talk. And unfortunately nobody did that. And then I'm dealing with the kids. Yeah, nobody. And then dealing with the kids having emotions in as many different directions as you could imagine, from one that was like, oh, well, baby's dead, we're moving on with life, and that's cool. And I'm like, okay, that's one way of dealing with it. To ones that were moody, to one that started having these bursts of anger, and he just didn't know what it was. And I said, you know, it's cool. You know, it's anger is one of those things that happens, and you're allowed to be angry. But this throwing toys around the house is not cool. So being angry is fine. How we deal with them without anger is something that we need to address. So if you're feeling angry, don't pick up that toy and throw it. You can maybe go outside and jump on the trampoline, or you can punch a pillow, but throwing things is not okay. So we've got to deal with this in a different way, and crying's okay. And then the older teens just being kind of quite distant and moody, and my eldest, she decided that she was going to take over and be the mother because she wanted to help me, but she also needed the emotional connection with the younger ones to help her feel, for her to feel a need as well. So yeah, things were interesting, and I kind of started to build myself a support network. So I had the social worker from the hospital who was phoning once or twice a week. I was in close contact with my GP because I'd spoken to him before I delivered, because with my first two children I had postnatal depression, and I was like, well, if there's anything that's going to kind of trigger that depression, it's going to be losing the baby, and I need something set up. So he sort of explored a bunch of avenues, and he said, mothers and babies, you don't have a baby, so you don't qualify for postnatal depression support. So he was at a loss. He said, look, if you need to talk, just come and see me and we'll make it work somehow. So that was really great. And I had contacted SANS, and one of the support people had been phoning as well. So I'd sort of built up a support network, and I had one really good friend who had she'd just come and she'd just sit, and we'd have coffee, and if I needed to cry, I'd cry, and if I needed to talk about football or something random, she was there to talk. So she was probably my lifeline. And then, yeah, one of my other coping mechanisms was I launched myself into 110 things. So I furiously started knitting blankets to be put in the memory boxes, and I started making gowns to go in memory boxes, and I started, well, quite early on, I wrote a lot of letters. So I wrote a letter of complaint to the radiology department outlining what had happened, where I felt the shortcomings were, what recommendations I would recommend that they put in place when they were dealing with, you know, a death of a baby or a confirmation of fetal demise or whatever it was. You know, I said maybe they should just take all the images they can, and, you know, ones that were, you know, the 3D images, anything, making sure that the women were actually in a fit state to leave, asking if they needed a support person, asking if they needed a quiet space just to sit for a while, to collect their thoughts, have a cup of water, just looking into some more kind of very practical patient care things if they didn't feel they had the emotional capacity to deal with that themselves. They sent me a bunch of flowers, which was kind of nice, but made me really angry because I was like, well, too little, too late. But they wrote me a lovely letter, and they assured me that they would be doing more staff program, staff training, and that they were going to try and ensure that this kind of thing didn't happen ever again. And for it to have happened once was a real failing on their part. But then adding on to that, I also had a lot of people I knew who said, oh no, well, that's just normal. I was treated like that. And they had this, there was this whole raft of horrible stories. And my response to that was I got really, really angry, and it was irrationally angry at all these women who'd been treated so poorly. I was angry at them because they hadn't complained and they hadn't done anything to ensure that this wouldn't have happened again. And then I sort of sat in the anger for a little while, and then I went, but it's really hard to kind of come to terms with the fact that you've been treated poorly, and that you always think, well, maybe I did something or I didn't do something, and grief is enough of a thing to deal with that without thinking, actually, I've got the strength and I've got the emotional capacity to do something about this. So I needed to sit in anger a little while before kind of bringing it back and thinking, actually, that's too much to ask of somebody when they were managing the best they could with the trauma and with, I'm going to just say abuse, because it is abusive behavior of the system. All those layers of things on top of the grief, and I'm like, actually, I'm one person and I can make a change, and I need to make that change because I can't blame everybody who's gone before, and I need to do something. So I did. And it was, I've since discovered in the years following that they were also the first radiology centre in New Zealand who had professional training for grief management. I'm just like, thank you that something actually has happened. The letters of complaint to the hospital weren't quite so fruitful. So I decided to get a little bit passive aggressive and figured if I can't change things from a systemic level, then I will try and affect change in other ways. So I was getting a little bit creative, was doing the gowns and the blankets, and then a friend sent me an article from Australia about cuddle cots, and I went, I've never seen or heard about this thing before. So I set a whole chain of fundraising kind of things in place. And so 6 months to the day, so it was on Baby Loss Awareness Day, we donated a cuddle cot to the hospital, which was the first one in a hospital in the country. So I was like, yeah,
amazing.
You're not going to be asking people to be putting their babies in fridges again if I can help it.
Exactly.
Because it's one thing that I can do.
I love that. And I just want to quickly stop you, because I know cuddle cots, but I didn't know them only a year ago. So if you could share with us a little bit more about that.
Okay, so a cuddle cot is just, how do you describe it? It's a pad that is put in a bassinet or on a surface, and it's connected to a machine, a cooling machine, that just pumps cool air underneath the baby. And it just keeps the air temperature around baby lower than room temperature, so the rate of decay is slowed without having to, what they used to do was take babies away and put them in either refrigerators if they were really small, or the hospital mortuary if they were larger babies, or they would put ice packs in and around the baby to keep them cool. And a friend of mine who had lost her baby at 37, I think 36 or 37 weeks, and it was her third baby, and she said just picking up her daughter to hold her, and she was damp and cold, and she said, you know, she just, it fought all her mothering instincts that babies need to be warm and dry, and she said, you know, she could deal with the fact that you know, the baby was cooler than what a living baby would be, but she struggled with the dampness that the ice created. Cuddle cots are a huge game changer in allowing parents more time after the baby has been delivered, just spending time. Mm-hmm. You know, they can pick the baby up and hold it. The babies are in the room with them. When they're in the cuddle cot, they're being cooled, so their bodies aren't declining as rapidly as they would without them. So it also makes it easier for staff, because they're not having to keep coming in and changing ice packs and checking, and you know, so it's plug it in, it goes, and I don't know, I've never used one, but I hear they're great.
Not a standard thing yet.
No, it's not, still not
in every hospital. It's not just in New Zealand. thing that is not happening. It's everywhere in the world. I really knew.
I think the last count, I think there were, because from that, quite a few people sort of asked me how to go about fundraising and things. I think there were 23 cuddle cots that I know of that are dotted around New Zealand. I know there's Dunedin, Queenstown, Invercargill, Rotorua, Wellington, not all the hospitals in Auckland, I don't think. I could be wrong. So they're getting there, and there's probably more that I don't know of, because people fundraise and they go into hospitals. I think Nelson has a couple now too. So yeah, they've kind of they're getting there, but it's still something people fundraise for. It's not something standard that hospitals have.
And if there is now anyone listening or watching this who thinks, hey, I want to support this because I would have loved to have that opportunity, or I had it and I took it for granted. We don't take really anything for granted, but I didn't know that it was not happening everywhere, and I want to support that cause and help to bring a cuddle cot in another hospital. What can they do?
It's tricky because there isn't an overseeing sort of organization that fundraises. It's all done individually. Mm-hmm. So it's really a matter of contacting your local hospital, because they may already have one, or there have been a couple of hospitals that have declined to have cuddle cots donated for varying reasons. So it's best to contact them, and then it's a matter of contacting the supplier in the United Kingdom. But I guess if anybody needs some sort of help with kind of organizing that stuff, they can maybe email me or something, or I can point them in the right direction, because things actually changed quite a bit since I got mine. There was an Australasian distributor, and mine came from Australia, but since then it's been a direct kind of arrangement with the company in the UK. Things have changed around a bit, but there's plenty of people that I can kind of, someone who's a bit more local, I can point them in the right direction, or there's people that I know throughout the country who have done those things.
Thank you. So if there is someone watching now, they can send me a message and I can reach out to you then.
Yeah.
Okay. And if that's happening more often, maybe I can take that
we'll
up too.
It'd be great. Yeah. So lots of things kind of happened. Relationship wise, we're still married. a lot of people kind of feel that when you lose a child, that's automatically a game changer for a marriage, and most marriages break up. I don't see that as being necessarily true. I probably know just as many people who've had a split in relationship as the number of people who have stayed with their partner. Sometimes things do get a little bit weird for a while. Sometimes I think you just have to sit down and really talk when you hit hurdles. I mean, I think our biggest hurdle was maybe about 6 weeks after our loss, and my mother had phoned, and she was telling me about my uncle's funeral. And I came off the phone and I was upset, and I'd sort of, my husband's like, oh, what's wrong? I said, oh, well, mum was talking about my uncle's funeral and she said a couple of things that has made me upset. It's fine, just leave it. he very foolishly kept asking me questions, like, what did you say? And I'm like, it's not important.
Yeah.
I'll get over it. It's just, she said a few things that were just not 100% what I wanted to hear, maybe. I don't know, but just leave it. I'll be fine tomorrow. He kept poking and then I cried. And I big ugly cried for maybe an hour or two. And I'm not the sort of person who cries. I don't cry easily. I don't cry frequently. So I cried and I cried and I cried and I cried and I cried myself to sleep.
How was that crying in general? I mean,
it just felt good. It just got rid of a whole lot of stuff that I was holding it in. I was holding myself together. I didn't have a lot of opportunity to release a lot of that emotion because you can't ugly cry in front of children. They get really stressed. Then you have to deal with their needs on top of your needs. So, yeah, it was great. It was the middle of the night. I let it all out. There was snot. There was tears. It was very cathartic.
Yeah. Well, I love a good cry. I don't know.
It was good. But the following morning, he was a little bit weird. He left the house really early to go to work. I thought, oh, maybe he's just got a meeting before work or whatever. And then my sister phoned and she was a bit weird and was like, oh, well, can I come and visit on the long weekend? And I was like, maybe something weird's going on with her and her family. And I'm like, yeah, sure. You can come and come over anytime. It's fine. And then the morning progresses and around 10 o'clock in the morning, I get a phone call from my GP and he's like, I got a message from somebody and they're concerned that you're going to hurt yourself or the kids. And I'm like, what? Hang about? What? And he says, think it was your husband or your sister or something. He said that somebody's phoned, they've left a message. He goes, can I come and visit? And I'm like, sure, you can come visit, but I'm actually fine. I said I had a jolly good cry last night. I'm feeling much better today. I feel like I'm slightly refreshed and I'm doing okay. So he came over and he says, what's this all about? And I said, look, I have no idea. I said, I cried last night, had a good howl. I'm feeling better today. I'd need to talk to the people who were involved before I know what's going on. So my husband comes home in the evening and I go, so what went on? He says, well, I was feeling really, really bad. And I figured if I was feeling that bad, then you were feeling worse and you were crying and you don't cry. And I was really worried that you were really depressed and suicidal or something. And he said, and you don't know, I've had the best day because after I talked to your sister, I felt like a whole weight had been lifted off of me and it's been really good. And I'm like, yeah, but do you know that you broke my support system that I had with the GP because I can't talk to him now because everything that I say to him is now kind of tainted by what you've said, which is not true. And I sort of said, so, you know, I've been really open and transparent and honest with you. And I've said, today's been a good day. Today's been a bad day. Today's whatever. And he said, I didn't trust that you were telling me the truth. And I was like, I beg your pardon. And I said, okay, end of discussion. I can't talk to you about this. So a few days later, I gave myself a chance to calm down, you know, have a bit of time to think. I wrote a letter to him saying, look, you know, this is how this has impacted on me. And I don't know that if you've realized that these were the systems I had set in place for myself and you've effectively destroyed those. And I gave him the letter and I said, look, read it when you're ready to talk about it, or if you want to write back to me, that's cool. So he wrote back and said, look, you know, I was having, I was feeling this way and whatever. But then I suddenly realized that actually I couldn't give him any of my grief. I couldn't trust him with that, and I couldn't let him be part of that anymore because I had to protect myself. So moving on from there, I then went forth and found a counsellor who I could see for free because we couldn't afford for me to see somebody professionally. So that was really good for me because I could go there once a week. I could say whatever I needed to say, and I knew it wasn't going to come back at me, and it wasn't going to get twisted. It was just said. And if I was having a good day or a bad day, I could just offload. So having that weekly appointment was enough to keep me afloat. I also, right from the beginning, I wrote a lot. So I have probably 16 anthologies of poetry. So I have documented a lot of things. So some of the very early stuff I wrote is very raw and very angry and very confused, and there's been a progression. But the other thing that really annoyed me when I was looking for things to read and relate to, most things regarding baby loss on the internet, when it's a poem or a saying or something, it's a warm and fluffy, like, oh, little babies with angel wings and clouds and snowflakes. And I need to let out some of this other stuff. You know, I don't subscribe to babies becoming angels and things, and I don't subscribe to it all being so lovely. And, you know, so I wrote things about being angry, and I wrote things about being really pissed off with certain people, and I wrote things about how I just wanted to go to sleep, and not like suicidal, but I just wanted to sleep because I was so exhausted from grief, from parenting, from relationships. I just wanted to get off the bus and just sit quietly,
take a break, and
just be. You know, whether it was just sit in a foul mood, I just, and I found the middle of the night to be a very good space for me. I'm not a good sleeper. And so I would be awake because grief has this very grand insomniac effect, and I'd be awake and I would write. And I wrote a lot of stuff. And then I started a Facebook page where I dumped a lot of stuff. And a few people who had kind of followed sort of said, oh, where are you putting things? And then I was being affirmed that actually you've managed to put into words things that I've been thinking and feeling, and I've just not been able to articulate it. And that for me was quite healing because I didn't feel like these random dark, weird thoughts were completely irrational, and that somebody else related and that somebody else was going through them.
Yeah.
And that was really good for me. So when I wrote a poem about, you know, people have shelves to put mementos on, and I'm like, I've got a box. I don't need a shelf. Why would you need a shelf? I've got a few really precious things. A few years down the track, I kind of wrote about, actually, I had a box, then I had a shelf. Now I think I need a cabinet to put all the things, because I kind of went, oh, I've got a beer, and someone sent a card that I want to put. And I made a picture, you know, scrapbook frame, or, you know, I've got all these things that are hers. That I want to be able to see. I don't want them in boxes anymore, and they don't all fit on my shelf. And it was things, and people say, yeah, it happens. You start off with, I've got footprints or I've got a blanket. And then, oh, someone sent this really cool thing that made them think of my baby. And I got sent something else, or I saw something that I just had to have because it made me think of her. And yeah, it's just, it's really interesting how many people have these thoughts that they thought were quite crazy.
Yeah, they're all,
and that they're actually quite normal. That a lot of us, we have those thoughts and we have those feelings, but because there's just slightly not quite what you'd think people in their rational brains would be doing and thinking. So yeah, writing has been a huge thing. So I wrote an article for Stuff when they did their miscarriage series a couple of years ago. I wrote a piece for a book that was published a year or two back, maybe 2 years ago, could be longer. I've had another article printed in a natural parenting magazine. There were quite a few different things that I've either had published or sort of I've contacted people who've then gone on to write articles about miscarriage or baby loss and stuff. So that's been really good. And it's kind of weird seeing your name in print because, yeah. But I think more importantly, I see Elizabeth's name in print. And yeah. I kind of think it's really odd to think that as far as the majority of people see her, that she didn't exist. She was a miscarriage. She, you know, essentially wasn't born. She wasn't here. She wasn't anything. To think that because of her, there's been a ripple. And her life has affected a lot of people's lives. And there are people that I know, you know, in Germany, in Switzerland, in the United Kingdom, in Australia, in America, they know her name. Mm-hmm. And they remember her. And, you know, they are connected. And we're connected through babies that we've all lost, but she has created a ripple. And because of her, there are people somewhere on the planet who have then gone, oh, Karen's done this or Karen's done that. Maybe we could try that in our local community. Or, oh, we know this person in New Zealand and they do these things. Maybe we can try doing some of those things here. And the same, it's like, I've spoken to people in other countries and go, oh, that's a really great idea. That would be so supportive and helpful.
Yeah.
And we can work with that here. So there is a community and it's a really supportive community if you get into the right spaces and if you're prepared to tell your story and you're prepared to listen. And that was one of the big things that with fundraising for the Cuddle Cot, and it happened. I'm not quite sure how things transpired, trying to get some publicity. We got quite a large photo in the local newspaper, and I go to a craft group at a retirement village, and so it's kind of hanging out with the elderly folk and socializing with them. And the number of ladies who came to me and said, I lost a baby, and they told me their story. And at first I was kind of like, I'm overwhelmed with the amount of grief and the sense of loss that these women have carried for so long with no support, with no acknowledgement. And I was like, this is too much responsibility for me because I don't feel like I'm worthy to be given your stories and being trusted to carry that forward as well. And I was just blown away by the number of old ladies who were just, they'd hug me and they'd be crying. And I'm like, this is only like a month or two after I've lost my baby, and I'm now carrying all this other grief, but it's not just the grief. It's the love that they've carried for so long. And it's such a privilege to be trusted with it.
Yeah.
Happy tears.
Grateful tears. Yeah. It is wonderful, all the things that you've been doing and all the things you, I think that proactive nature, and we all cope differently, but I can really see that as part of your healing, healing process, to proactively write about it, share it, and get that confirmation. And with that, helping also other women in the same experience is so healing too, in the sense of you're validated, you get the validation for exactly that. I can totally relate to what you're saying. and they are validated in their feelings. It's not just you. So that is that ripple effect. So I completely agree with that and have had similar experiences so far. Thank you.
Yeah. No, there's also probably part of it. I have no idea how I fix myself, so I'll fix everybody else.
Do you feel like you still have some work to do around, and I don't feel like we need to fix ourselves, because I don't think like we are necessarily and broken in the sense of we need to be repaired, because I think we are okay the way we are, and feeling sad and feeling grief and anger is not broken.
Yeah, no, not, and I think in terms of, in some ways I'm kind of lucky, that the way I was raised was that death was just part of life. And so growing up in a small, well, grew up in Dunedin and being part of a very close-knit ethnic community, being part of the Chinese community, feeling much if anyone in that community died, then we went to the funeral. So from the time I was small, I can remember going to funerals, and in Chinese culture, they've got quite kind of defined rituals around grief. So, you know, the wearing of certain colors, you wear a band on your arm for 3 months after the death of somebody to signal to the outside world that you were grieving. So to have that kind of recognition and some of those things quite ingrained in me has been helpful. I've seen death on a lot of levels, with having lost friends, you know, people I know whose parents have passed, or grandparents, or my niece died when she was 18, and a friend was murdered while I was, you know, all kind of different facets of grief and death. And you know, it's, I've never been shielded from it. So when Elizabeth died, I was like, grief is like, it's like a blanket that I carry, and for now I'm just gonna pull it over my head again and just kind of sit. And as weird as it is, there's comfort in grief as well, in terms of that you know you've loved deeply, and that not necessarily like there is that loss, but grief is not a negative emotion, and that you can sit with it and you can carry with it, and it'll jump up and bite you from time to time, and it'll hit you in the most unexpected ways. But you can sit with grief. And I knew from experience that I can live through grief, and that for me, grief sort of dissipates, or doesn't really dissipate. It kind of, you grow around it and you carry it with you. So every experience of grief is built on your previous experience, and it's built around the relationship that you have. So it's a unique experience every time. So I knew I was going to survive this, and I knew that there was life beyond, I'm not going to say after, but beyond. And I knew that, you know, my children were going to travel through it. And I kept saying to them, it's not going to be this intense. It's still going to be there. You're still going to feel sad. You're still going to feel angry. Sometimes it's still going to be there, but your lives will get busy, and, you know, the spaces in your heart will fill up with other things again, and you'll enjoy things. And there's going to be a day that we're going to, you know, laugh about something that might be quite inappropriate, because our coping mechanisms are kind of bordering on inappropriate humor. And I spoke to them openly and honestly. So when they said, oh, hey, cremation, is that like when you put things in the fire and it burns up, and then it's like if you wanted to put like a piece of rubbish in or something? And I was like, well, yeah, basically cremation is, it's a big fire and bodies get burnt down to ashes. And what are the reasons why we need to do that? So then we talked about health and hygiene, and, you know, we've walked past hedgehogs on the road, and we've related all those things in. And I said, you know, there's all these things, and what are some of the things that we can do when we're feeling bad or sad? And you can ask me any questions. And there were no questions that were off the table. I said, I may not be able to answer that right now, but we'll answer it. And, you know, even questions like, well, can we just get another baby? And I was like, well, you know, we could, but it wouldn't replace the one that we've lost. And then it was, well, would another baby die too? And I says, well, there's no guarantees. It might be fine and it might not. It's one of those things that we don't know. We have to just be ready to take a chance. And I mean, that was probably 2 or 3 weeks after. So I wasn't thinking about having another baby, but, you know, yes, could, but it's not going to be the same baby, and it's not going to take away those feelings that we're feeling. It's not going to be a magic thing. So any of those questions, or, you know, and hopefully that's kind of given them some of the skills and some of the understanding that it's actually okay. And I'm like, I'm feeling really angry today. Or, I mean, I still did shield them from a lot of the stuff that was going on, because it's about age appropriateness. And I didn't want to overload them with stuff. But yeah, basically it was, this is what's happened, this is what's going to happen. You know, these are the processes we're going to go through. This is the emotional stuff. Everybody's different. And that's something that we have to deal with. But, you know, we've just had her birthday and we couldn't do some of the things we usually do. So that was, but it was actually an okay day. We had cake. We have like a little birthday party on her birthday every year. We have cake and candles, and this year, so we usually try and do that and then go and watch the sunset or the sunrise. So yeah, strange times. We couldn't get out. So the kids, I said, oh, you know, years ago we used to have a birthday wall that for any of their birthdays we'd make a little mural on the wall. So they sat down for the afternoon and we cut out little animals and things and stuck them on the birthday wall. And then while I was busy doing something, well, she's now 9. She'd gone and she'd cut out the letters of Elizabeth's name and stuck them all up on the wall. So, you know, every year we have Elizabeth a day. And we always try and do something positive. And you know, have some food and, yeah, just try and put a bit of a positive spin on the day. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it's, yeah, interesting kind of anniversary month this year. It's, in fact, I've actually avoided a lot of the triggers this year because we haven't been able to go to church and we haven't gone to an Anzac service, and they're quite triggering in themselves, but yeah, I find them quite hard, and so we haven't done those, so it's been interesting. Kind of good though.
Different.
Yeah.
From usual. I can imagine. I'm glad that you kind of like that experience too. It's
yeah, it's, you know, there's positives everywhere. You just have to think about it and find them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not being the eternal optimist or anything.
I, in between my notes, and I had like some questions popping up, but I feel like we already have like cut into so many topics, and it would be amazing to talk deeper about them, but I think it would be eventually too much for one one conversation and one person to take in and listen. I've written down three words that I kind of wanted to underline for everyone who's listening, that I personally think are really important, but I also know from other people that once a day went into openness means I'm open to talk about what happened. I'm open to talk about death in general. I'm okay to answer questions. That kind of helps, even if it's hard. And sometimes you have this like, actually, I can't say anything, but okay. Once you get over this and you kind of try anyways, it's kicking in a healing process that some of us can't do from the beginning. Some of us need a year before that happens, or longer, and everything is okay. But I think that allowance is a really important part. Well, that openness is a really important part. The second word I've written down is allowance. And I think that came out really, really good in what you were explaining, like all the emotions that are coming up are okay, and I can just sit with them. And I think that allowance and saying, okay, I feel grief, I feel anger, and I actually can handle it, and it is okay to be there, makes such a huge difference too. And that is how we grow up, our programming, to beating yourself up for feeling this way. I should not feel angry right now. I should not feel sad. 3 months are over. By now, I should be fine. That makes it all like that kind of just heightens that emotion and that whole pressure around the whole topic. And that's not just the same. It's the same for every area of life. It's not just in grief, but that allowance. And I'm sure it will come up in other conversations, but until now, I never had anyone talking about those rituals. I talked about it in a previous podcast episode just on my own, but the ritual celebration of birthdays or other ways to remember and quote unquote celebrate, because this human being is part of our life and will always be. I think that is something that for a lot of us in society is still new and somehow hard to include in our life. And I've been talking to people and they just found it weird that I'm celebrating my son's birthday and that I say, oh, I'm baking a cake and, you know, Simon would have turned 4 today. And they're like, What? What's wrong with you? I'm like, well, this really helps me. And I don't even feel, oh, well, I mean, it's been different every year, but this year I did not feel bad or sad. I just feel so much love and gratefulness also for the part he had in my life that I can't ignore that day. I want to acknowledge him.
Yeah.
And I will always love him. Like, even if I stop baking cakes.
Yeah. You don't have to have cake. Too much cake.
Yeah. Eventually, you know, all the sugar. But we all have different ways. And I think having the acknowledgement and allowing ourselves to remember helps a lot and is an important part. Thank you. I am, I think it is time to end it. One question that I would like to ask you, I've been asking before, what is one thing that you would like to tell that version of yourself that left the hospital that day where you felt so surreal?
It's a good question. I have to say that actually, even though I felt so kind of isolated and alone and devastated and grief-stricken and all the things, I knew that I was gonna get through this. Mm-hmm. I knew I was going to be okay, and I knew I was going to be a different and better version of myself. What I think would have been nice to have known was how hard and how much the universe was going to throw at me. So all the barriers and all the things, right from the diagnosis right through, if I had known how much I could carry and how much I could turn around and use, I think, but then maybe if I'd known how hard it was going to be, I might not have been okay. So yeah, I don't know that I would tell myself anything. Just keep breathing, keep moving through it, stop and just be. Actually, no, stop and just be is not something that I ever do. I don't stop. And I think that's one of my coping mechanisms, is I don't stop, because if I stop long enough, I might think and I might feel more than I think I can cope with. So if I keep moving and I keep things at kind of constant level, then I'm coping. And some people might argue that I'm kind of not coping with it and I'm not dealing with some of it, but I think life is fluid and grief is fluid, and so you kind of just keep moving through it and things change. And if there's, I guess maybe that is it, it's just things change, things are going to change, things might get better, things might get worse, but they're always going to change, and it's not going to be like this all the time. Yeah, maybe that's it, I don't know. It's one of those tricky things.
Yeah, I think it is a good thing to know and to be aware of and to really live that, life is constant change, and knowing that everything that we're feeling right now that might feel overwhelming and just too much will not feel like this forever. It will always flow, and you know, things might go and come and maybe come back, but it will never stay exactly the same. And that's kind of a way of seeing hope, no matter how hopeless and dark it seems in the moment.
It's a bit hot under this light.
I will let you go and enjoy the rest of your night. Okay. I just want to say thank you, because I think there was a lot of really, really valuable information, and also just thank you for being so open and sharing your story and letting other people know what you went through. Is there anything that you want to say? No, that you can't, even if you would like to. Okay.
Well, I don't know that there's much more to say. If you really want to know everything that I've ever said, you can look it up. I've written a bunch of stuff.
Where do we find that if we want to know?
I guess some of the publications were magazines and stuff, so I'm not sure they'll ever be found. What was my Facebook page is called The Elephant Speaks.
Okay.
Just because I felt like it was addressing the elephant in the room that nobody actually was talking about. So, and the whole association thing is that I associate elephants with Elisabetta, probably because of that. So yeah, it's there. The book that I wrote for is called The First Year After Child Loss. Now I've got a copy of the book somewhere. I can give you the details for that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, if you come up with anything else that you would like to share, message it to me and I will just put it with the video details. Then people can find you and where you
can find all the things and all the places. It's like my family's like, what is she doing that again? Why is she in the news? Why is she in, you know, my husband goes, oh, so you're in the paper or you're on the news or on the TV for something. Did your family call? And I'm like, they just go, what's she up to again? She said, why? So I think it's a bit funny. And my kids, they're really, really funny too, because they say, oh, well, you know, we just tell people that if you make mum angry, she'll just get her vengeance by being kind to you and making you change your mind. And I'm like, if that's one thing you've learned in this life, then I'm doing okay.
Yeah, that's because, a good way of vengeance. You know,
because they said, oh no, you just go out and do nice things for people. Even when you're really annoyed with them, you go and do nice things. And I said, if you can't change the world by example, it's not going to change. So you need to do something about it. So I'm like, maybe we're winning on the parenting front. Can't tell sometimes.
It sounds like it. Awkward,
but I don't know. You've not met my kids.
Thank you. I think it's a nice quote to end on. If you can't change the world by leading by example, it's just not worth it. It's vengeance. It's not.
It's
not the way.
Being angry, I can't do angry. Angry is exhausting. If there's one emotion that just drains you, anger probably is it. And I'm too tired to be angry. can't. Yeah. It yeah. takes a lot of energy.
It takes a lot of energy. I think for me, personally, I think it is okay to be angry, but if I see myself just going around in anger yeah. and thinking,
well, no, I think being angry is fine.
Yeah.
But I know people who can stay angry for weeks and months, yeah. and I can be angry about things and I can be affronted by things, but I can't stay angry all the time. I need to do something about it, and I just can't operate like that. It's exhausting.
Yeah, and that's the way I see it too. Like, the one thing with anger is that, or with hate, and if you're in all those negative emotions, it is not affecting the person that you're angry with.
Yeah.
That they're like in their own different world. They don't really get anything of it. It's draining you. It's you who's getting a heart attack.
And that's the thing. And people say, well, how can you forgive? Because I'll glibly say to people, you know, Elisabetta was part of a larger lesson about forgiveness. And they're like, that makes no sense. I say, well, there were all these things that I had to forgive. And they says, well, you didn't have to. And I said, well, I did, because I had to forgive. Forgiveness isn't about the person who's done the thing. It's about me. And for me to be able to say, well, I forgive that, and I accept that that's happened, and I accept I have no control over it. But the forgiveness part is when I say, I'm letting it go. And in that process, I'm going to absolve you of your responsibility and your tie to me because of that.
Yeah.
And I said, forgiveness is not about you, it's about me. And I forgive because I need that peace and I need that closure, because anger and vengeance is exhausting.
Yeah.
Really, really is.
Yeah.
You can go around wanting to hate people. It's exhausting.
Yeah. I agree. And that's one of my biggest things too. Like, I learned to forgive, and I'm still in the process of forgiving things that have been longer in my past that I've been carrying around. But forgiveness is so powerful for yourself, not for the person.
Yeah, not. Yeah.
Okay. I'll end on this note.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for everything you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. I will let you know as soon as I have that all ready to be sent out. And if you could share that would be amazing.
Yeah.
For everyone who's watching at the moment, if you see this and think it could be valuable for anyone, if you can share that too, we would be incredibly thankful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.